Good morning. Today is one of my favorite days of the year. It's a sign that spring is coming. It'll be light tonight, later in the evening, and so it's worth it to give up the hour. It's like waking up early on a vacation day or Christmas day because you know that day is going to be a good day. And so as you look at the weather, all these things are pointing to spring coming, and so we can rejoice, right, in that and be glad about that. Maybe you're not, but let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy 6. When I was 17 years old, went to the mailbox and got the mail and went inside and took out a letter, and it said right on it, "You are a guaranteed winner." And if you're younger than me, maybe you don't remember sweepstakes letters. I don't know if they still send them. I don't see them as much anymore, at least. But there were these things that they would send out, and they would say, like, "You have won $1 million." And I knew about those. Like, I was not going to fall for that trap. But this one was different. It said, "Guaranteed winner." And then it had these scratch-offs on it, kind of like a scratch-off lottery ticket. And so you had to scratch off to see what your prize was going to be. And some of the prizes that you scratched off might have been something real small. The one I scratched off said $5,000. Oh, my goodness. I was rich. I got out the classified ads. It was called the Thrifty Nickel. It was this newspaper where you could post if you wanted to sell something. And I started looking at the cars. And I found a Chevy Camaro for $4,000. I'd still have $1,000 to spare. And so I called my dad. I was telling him the good news. And he said, "Daniel, it's probably just one of those sweepstakes." And I said, "Dad, come on. Like, I know about those. This says guaranteed." And I explained the scratch-off system to him. Turns out he was right. As the truth of my financial condition started to sink in, and I realized that my dream of a Camaro was dying, and a little piece of me dying with it, I had, though, that afternoon, the feeling of being rich, and it was fun. It was fun to be rich as I was looking through that classified ad. Don't you wish that you never had to think about money? Don't you wish that you were rich so you could do whatever you wanted, so you could go anywhere you wanted, you could have anything you wanted, and you never had to worry about money? Don't you want to be rich? And I'm not going to answer this. I'm not going to raise my hand because I know this is a sermon. I know the Bible says things about money. I'm not exactly sure where he's going with this. But as you think about that, you know the Bible talks about money in over 2,000 verses, either about silver or gold or wealth or debt or poverty or inheritance or stewardship. The Bible talks about money a lot. And so what does it say? What does the Bible teach us about the way that we view money, the way that we view our desire for riches? It talks about it a lot, even in 1 Timothy. As we've been going through this letter, it's God's design for the church, and already in several of the chapters, finances have popped up. In chapter 2, Paul's warning about some women in the church who were flaunting their wealth with extravagant clothes and jewelry in ways that were distracting, drawing unnecessary attention to themselves. In chapter 3, as he's giving the qualifications for leaders in the church, for elders and deacons, he says that they should not be lovers of money or greedy. In chapter 5, he's giving instructions about how we should care for the financial needs of our family, or how the church should care for the financial needs of widows or those in need. Also talks about paying fairly those who are leaders in the church. But when we come to chapter 6, he doesn't just mention money in passing. In chapter 6, he's going to slow down and talk about how we think about resources in three different sections. First, he's going to give this overall principle that godliness with contentment is great gain. And then he's going to give warnings about the desires of our heart, warnings about those who really want to be rich. And then we're going to skip to verses 17 and 19, where he gives instructions for those people who already are rich. So that talk about money starts in verse 6. I'm going to read those starting in verse 3. And these first few verses, he's talking about false teachers. I'm not going to focus on that because already in our series, the theme of false teaching has come up a few different times. But you're going to see how that kind of launches him into money, because he's saying these false teachers are using godliness as a means, as a way to get gain. And then he's going to talk about what true gain is. So let's look at 1 Timothy 6, starting in verse 3. He says, if anyone teaches false doctrine and does not agree with the sound teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ and with the teaching that promotes godliness, he's conceited and understands nothing, but has an unhealthy interest in disputes and arguments over words. From these come envy, quarreling, slander, evil suspicions, constant disagreement among people whose minds are depraved and deprived of the truth. Here, look, he says, who imagine that godliness is a way to material gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world. We can take nothing out. If we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation, a trap, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, and by craving it, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Skip over verses 11 through 16. We'll look at those next week. Verse 17, he picks back up on this theme of money. He says, instruct those who are rich in the present age not to be arrogant or to set their hope on the uncertainty of wealth, but on God, who richly provides us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do what is good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and willing to share, storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of what is truly life. As he begins this section, he's saying, there are some false teachers among you that are viewing godliness, I'll put it in air quotes, which is this life of worship of God. They're using that as a means, a way to get gain, financial gain. And so what's that revealing about their hearts? It's showing that their true end is financial gain, and they're using God or the worship of God or religion as a means to get what they really want, as a way to get what they really want, what they're really seeking, their real treasure. And so he flips that and he says, no, godliness, which is, it's a word that's shown up several times in 1 Timothy, godliness is a life of devotion, of worship of God in such a way, so it's a heart of seeing God as my treasure that then is going to evidence itself, it's going to work itself out in a life that reflects him, a life that is like him, a life that sees God and wants to imitate his character. And so that's true godliness. He says, no, godliness with contentment is great gain. It's not a means to great gain. It's God who is great gain, and seeking him and pursuing him, he is the true treasure. The word contentment that he uses there, he's pulling from Greek philosophy. The Stoics and the cynics of that day used this word of contentment to mean self-sufficiency. And they would teach that don't look for happiness in the stuff of this world or in other people, because those things can let you down. So the ideal philosophy, the ideal is to be self-sufficient so that nothing can take that from you. That's what even apart from God. That's what the secular philosophers of the day were teaching. And Paul's flipping that on its head as well. He's saying, no, don't be self-sufficient. Be God-sufficient. Be Christ-sufficient. See him as the one. Be dependent on him. Yourself is going to let you down as well. And so he's saying, no, it's putting these two things together. Godliness, a life of devoted worship of him, seeing him as the treasure, and being completely satisfied in him. If that's true, then that is great gain. It's mega gain is the Greek word that he uses there to describe it. It's great. It's the true gain. It's contentment. So what is contentment? It's a deep satisfaction, peace that comes from knowing God has provided and will provide for me all that I truly need. Think about that. Not necessarily all that I want, not necessarily the way that I think it should go, but it's a peace, it's a satisfaction, it's a rest that comes from knowing my God is what I ultimately need. He's the true treasure. If I have him, whatever it is that he's provided me, whatever circumstances I'm in, I can be satisfied, I can be content, I can be at peace because I have him. And so then Paul starts to give warnings because we're naturally pulled away from that. And the way he describes it, he's saying warnings to those who want to be rich. Actually, three different verbs that describe heart attitudes. Want, he says. And then he says the love of money. So he doesn't say that money itself is the root of all evil. He says the love of it. And then in verse 9, he says those who crave it, those who are craving money. Sorry, that's verse 10. Those who are craving it have wandered away from the faith. And so all three of those are talking about a desire. So regardless of whether you have money, a lot, or you don't have much at all, this temptation could still be ours. It's possible to be present in all of us. And so what he says then is, it's deceitful. He says it's like a trap, that kind of desire that says, that's my ultimate desire, that ultimately money is what drives me. It drives my life. It's what helps me make decisions is because I'm pursuing that, I'm craving that. He said, that's a deceitful trap. You fall into it. There were traps, a hunting term. I like to hunt. But I don't trap a whole lot. I trapped a raccoon in my yard once. What I've got more experience with trapping recently is mice. We had some mice in our house. Holly didn't like that for some reason, kind of a complainer. No, I'm just kidding. So she sent me to the store to get mouse traps. You ever been to the mouse trap section in the store? There are so many options. There's these glue traps that you can get where you just... It's this little piece of paper that's sticky on one side, and you set that out, or cardboard kind of, and you set that out, and you're trying to place it in a place where the mouse is just naturally going to go. So it's just running about its normal day, making its rounds or whatever, and it runs across. It doesn't see. It's just thinking about other things, just following its instincts, and it runs right into this trap, and it's stuck there, and it can't move until you come find it. And then you have to figure out how to dispose of it. Or there's the spring traps. These don't just rely on the mouse running its normal course. These actually have a bait that lures it in. So you put cheese, or I use peanut butter, put peanut butter on that trap, and the mouse smells it, and it's going to draw them in. And so they're so focused on that delicious reward that they don't see the trap. This is how traps work. It's because you don't notice them. Or sometimes I'm told, I looked this up, sometimes mice figure out that it's a trap. And they can figure out, they're trying to figure out, how can I get the food off, even though it's a trap? And sometimes they're good at that. I came out one morning, and all the peanut butter was gone. And it doesn't make sense. I just touched that spring with a little toothpick, and it snapped. But somehow, the mouse was able to get that off. And so then I bought some better traps that don't do that. So the mouse, again, okay, it sees that and it thinks, okay, that's I can get that. I can get that bait. Maybe it knows it's a trap. Okay, so what does this teach us? about traps. Traps only work if you're deceived. Only work either if you don't pay attention to it, you don't even know it's there, or if you see it, but you think, I can beat it. I'm the one who can handle this. I'm the one who can love both money and God. I can pull this off in a way. And you think, I can do this. I can grab just enough, just a little bit of it. And you're still being deceived. And so traps work because they're deceptive. And so that should cause all of us to think today, I shouldn't think that this temptation could never happen to me. It could be that we're being deceived even right now, that just running along the course of this world, just going throughout our lives and just seeing this stuff and thinking it, more stuff will satisfy me, and just going along our day, and we don't even notice that there's a trap there. And so Paul here is saying, beware, it's a trap, it's deceptive. And then he says, it's not just deceptive, it's destructive. And so he's shining this light. He's pointing the headlights on this dangerous part of the trap to make sure that we see it, to see how it can plunge us into ruin. He says, many foolish and harmful desires which plunge people into ruin and destruction. This is the way that it can wreck our lives. It can ruin our marriages. It can ruin our kids, ruin our families. It can leave us overwhelmed with anxiety and with greed. There's destructiveness. How does it destroy us? He says, because. Here's one of the ways. It's because it's going to lead you to more and more and more evil. This is that verse that you've heard, the love of money. It's the root of all kinds of evils. Ananias and Sapphira in Acts experience this as a love for money and a greed led them to other kinds of evil. It can lead to dishonesty in small ways, or just a selfish hurting of other people or slandering them because I'm trying to climb the ladder of success because I'm only worried about my own finances. My own greed leads me then to that. It can lead us to setting aside God, or I'm too busy for Him, I'm too busy for church, I'm too busy for reading His word or prayer because I've got to chase this dream, I've got to chase this financial success, or I've spent so much in trying to make myself happy that now I'm chasing the debt to try to climb out of that, and it deceptively destroys. It leads to then other kinds of evil, other kinds of sin, and he says it leads away from salvation. He says some by craving it have wandered away from the faith. Jesus talked about this in that parable of the sower in Mark 4, the worries of this age, the deceitfulness of wealth, the desires for other things enter in and choke the word. It becomes unfruitful. Paul told a story, a little sentence about this in 2 Timothy. It talks about Demas, who for the love of this world has deserted me. In Matthew 19, the rich young ruler, when offered with the choice, he walked away from Jesus because he valued his stuff more than Jesus. It led him away from salvation. And then it leads then to this stinging pain and regret, piercing themselves, says, with all kinds of pain, with many griefs. The anxiety and the fear and the worry about how am I gonna get out of this? How am I gonna survive? How am I gonna get what I want? If I just had that, then I'd be happy. And it leads to things, and then you look back, and if I wasted my life chasing those things. When Paul was saying, go for contentment, pursue godliness with contentment, he says, we brought nothing into this world, and we can take nothing out. come into this world naked, helpless, with nothing. And he says, when you die, no matter how much wealth you've accumulated in this life, we brought nothing in, we can take nothing out. Elon Musk, the richest person in the world, $350 billion. When he enters into eternity, he can't take any of that with him. I'm not picking on Elon. Same's true for us. Even you with your measly $1 billion or whatever you have. The credits don't transfer. That money, it can't be spent in eternity. It's like playing this Monopoly game, and you end up doing really well, you're successful, and you have all this, it's valuable in the game, and then you take that Monopoly money, and you walk into the bank, and you hand it to them, and they say, no, that's worthless here. It's valuable in the game, but it's worthless in real life. And in the same way, our money and our riches and our wealth, they're valuable in this life, but they don't transfer. But Paul's saying there are some things that you can live for that do transfer. There are some things that are great gain. And so he's saying, approach life, approach your money with this eternal perspective in mind. That's why Paul could say for himself, we are content with just food and clothing. At the time, Paul didn't have a family, and he was probably traveling around, and that could have been, when he's writing this, all that he had. And what he's just saying is, whatever you have, whatever needs God is meeting for you, in that state that you find yourself in right now, you can be content, knowing that there are things that matter more than our stuff. So how do we know? How do we know if we're valuing money too much in a wrong way? Because the Bible also talks about working hard and good stewardship and enjoying God's gifts, those kinds of things, providing for our family. And so how do we know if my desire to provide, my desire for riches are right desires, or if it's crossed over into this wrong kind of want and love and craving? I think we ask ourselves some questions. Be honest, we need God's Spirit to search our hearts and ask some evaluative questions. Am I seeing in my life any little ways where my love for money is causing me to compromise spiritually? Little ways, little deceptions, little lies, little things, because if I do, it'll get me a little bit more. Or am I seeing in my heart, oh, I'm never actually happy. I'm never actually satisfied. I keep thinking that's what will make me happy, but the bar keeps changing. I used to think if I just made that, I'd be content, and now I need to make more, and now I need to make more, and it's not because inflation, although that's true, but also just I keep thinking if I just had more stuff, then, and so you start to evaluate, am I looking for contentment in all the wrong things? Do you find it hard to say no to financial opportunities, even if they negatively impact your relationships or your spiritual life? Are you too busy for God, too busy for a church, too busy for your family, maybe provide for them, but you can't invest in them, you can't ever be with them, you can't think about how to lead them spiritually or care for them? Can you be content even if your financial condition never improves? Never changes or changes worse? These are the kinds of questions, uncomfortable questions sometimes we can ask, but are good for us to ask because we're remembering there is a dangerous snare. There is this line that as we give into that, we can fall into this trap of thinking that's what will ultimately satisfy. And then it shifts and becomes our treasure. How do we fight against it? It's by rightly placing what is the real treasure. It's by saying, no, it's Christ. But put in front of your eyes that he is worth it, that he is better. This is what Paul says in Philippians chapter 3. He says, everything that was gained to me, I've considered to be a loss because of Christ. Christ is worth it, so everything else is secondary. More than that, I consider everything to be a loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ. In Hebrews 13, verse 5, it says this. Listen to what's maybe surprising about how these two things are related. He says, keep your life free from the love of money. Be satisfied with what you have. Okay, that makes sense. Now what he says next is, for he himself said, I will never leave you or abandon you. What? How does the presence of God help us and be a reason for why we're free from the love of money and satisfied with what we have? It's because he is the real treasure. He is worth it. He is what we should be pursuing. And so this world says to us, the devil says to us, our own flesh says to us that you need more and more and more stuff to be happy. And Jesus says, no, I am enough. The world says you must hold on to wealth to be secure. And Jesus says, no, cling to me. I will never leave you or forsake you. The world says, treasure me. Treasure success, treasure status, treasure comfort. And Jesus says, no, I'm the treasure. And if you seek me and treasure me, you will have eternal riches. And so Paul gives this overarching principle. Godliness with contentment is great gain. And he gives these warnings. Beware. There are temptations. There are snares you can fall into wrongly ordered love for stuff. And then he starts talking about other things. Verses 11 through 16, which we're going to look at next week. Look at the end of verse 16. It seems like he finishes the letter there. The end of verse 16, he gives this doxology. God will bring this about in his own time, verse 15. He's the blessed and only sovereign, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, who alone is immortal, who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. To him be honor and eternal power. Amen. I don't know exactly how the rest of this letter came. I can imagine. It seems to me like he sets his pen down. He's done. And then he thinks, now I got to add a P.S. Picks it back up. Because he's thinking, I'm writing to this church, and I've given all these warnings about this desire to be rich. And you know what? In that church, there are some really poor people. There are some people in that church that are desiring riches, and he's warning about that. But you know what? Also in that church, there are some rich people. I need to give them some instructions. Help Timothy know how to speak to those who already are rich. And so here we have instructions for those who are rich. In verse 17, he says, instruct those who are rich in this present age not to be. And you might kind of think that's where he's going to stop. Okay, yep. Don't be rich. That's not where he stops, is it? That's not what it says. It says not to be arrogant. And so he never says it's wrong to be rich. Jesus gave that call to the rich young ruler. Sell all that you have. Give it away so you can give then the money to the poor. That's not a command that he gives to every Christian. It doesn't tell all of us that we can't own anything, that it's wrong, that we should feel guilty if we have more than food or clothes. In the Bible, there are some rich people. Abraham's filthy rich. Job, even richer. It says that Job was the wealthiest in the East before his temptation came, his trial. And then, after Job persevered through that, what does it say? God gave him back even more, poured it on him, poured it on Job. Job was rich. In the New Testament, Lydia was a successful businesswoman who supported the church and gave for the sake of Christ's kingdom. In Luke 8, there are some other women who says they support the ministry of Jesus and seems like they had some wealth. There were also people who had homes large enough to host the gathered church for worship in some of these house churches. And I don't know how large those churches were, how large those homes were, but decent-sized homes. And so the call isn't that if you have riches, that you feel bad about that, that's sinful, that's wrong. But there are warnings, there are commands, there are greater responsibilities that are given. Jesus did say how hard it is for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God. He did say it's hard. And it might be because of the two things Paul warns about here. He says, instruct those who are rich not to be arrogant and not to set their hope on their riches. Phil Ryken said there's two false things that they're placing trust in there. There's a false sense of importance, and there's a false sense of security that are natural temptations of those who have much. Now, many of you here might be thinking, I can tune out. This doesn't apply to me. I'm not rich. And that could be true. There, just like the church Paul was writing to, there are some people in that church that were very poor. And there are some people there that were very rich. And that's true of this church as well. There are some of you here that do not have much at all. And by every standard, we'd be in poverty. And there are some who are very rich. Probably none of us would say that. None of us, maybe none of you feel rich. But for all of us, many of us, as you think about how do we compare with most people around the world, most of us do have more than just our food and clothes. Most of us have more than that. Most of us have been given gifts. And so, but here, regardless of whether you think you're rich or not, these principles are still actually good for all of us. They are. They're good principles that every one of us should apply to ourselves, not to be arrogant, not to think whatever I have gives me an excuse to look down on someone else. Oh, they must be lazy. They must not have worked as hard as I have. They must not be as smart as I am. They haven't figured this out to be able to live the way that I have lived. And there's an arrogance that can come with wealth. But there's also this false sense of security and hope of thinking that what I have means I don't have to trust God. I don't need him. I've got all that I need. I don't need to pray for my daily bread. I've got what I need. You know what? Here he says, that's uncertain. Whatever you have, it's uncertain. This, let's go to the extreme. We are a few nuclear bombs away from the economy of this world collapsing. I don't know if that will happen. I hope that doesn't happen. It could happen to where everything in our bank account no longer is worth anything. And we're back to having to grow food and, you know, whatever. That could. But let's go closer to home. Maybe more likely. Some of you have lived this where you had a good job and lost it. Had job that made life pretty easy, and then it's gone. So here he's saying, don't set your hope on your riches. They're uncertain. They can be gone like that. So he's saying, place your hope in God who richly provides. Even look at this sentence, though. He says, who richly provides us with all to enjoy. And so again, here, it is right and good for us to enjoy gifts that God has given. It's not wrong for us to enjoy what God has given us and to have grateful hearts for that, for what he has given us, to enjoy them. But then he gives some instructions. So he's saying, here's some things don't do. Don't be arrogant. Don't set your hope in them. Do, instruct them to do good, to be rich. He uses that word rich again. Be rich in good works. Be known for how much you're serving others, how your life is about doing good for others. And he gives some specific ways about being generous. He says to be generous and willing to share, not clinging to everything that you have, not living and just at such a right at the edge of your means of just spending it all on yourself so that you have nothing to give, nothing to share, nothing to be generous with. So he's saying, no, do this. And then here's the motivation for that. He says, motivated by this, that you're storing up treasure for themselves, a good foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of what is truly life. So what's he come back to again? He's saying, okay, even for those who are rich, put in front of them this eternal perspective. That the way that we use our money here in this life, through generosity, through gratefulness, through thankfulness, through sharing, through investing, through stewardship, through giving for the sake of God's kingdom, that these things, the way that we live, lays up treasure in heaven is the way Jesus said it. That there are things that pass from this life to the next. There are ways that our money can be a tool, a means, as a way to bring honor to God, rather than God being a means as a way to get what we really want, which is money. And so here are some clever ways people have talked about this. They've asked this question. Do you possess your possessions, or do they possess you? It's a good way to think about it. Am I worshiping the gifts that God has given me, or am I worshiping the giver of those gifts? Am I trusting in the provision, or am I trusting in the one who provides? How do we know? How do we know if Christ is our treasure? As I close, I want us to ask some more questions, to search our hearts. Is Christ my treasure? Or is money or stuff my treasure? Think about your trust and anxiety. Am I trusting in God's provision, marked more by that? Or am I marked more by an anxiousness or this constant hamster wheel of wanting more, constantly chasing, if I just have that? Okay, am I joyful, thankful for what I have, thinking about what God has given me, what I do have, or am I complaining, thinking mostly about what I don't have? Can I rejoice in what others have, in others' success? Or do I find myself looking at others with envy? I wish I had that. Do I recognize that stuff is temporary? It's a tool. Or do I seek security? Am I putting my hope in possessions? Am I joyfully generous? I think my life. Do I take joy in giving? Or do I cling tightly to whatever it is that I have? Godliness with contentment is great gain. It's great gain. So reject the lie of the devil and the world that says that more and more and more stuff and money is what will make you happy. It's a sweepstakes scam. It won't ultimately satisfy. It's not real. Christ is the real treasure. He is worth more than all the money in the world. And so think with eternal perspective that as you pursue Christ, as you pursue godly contentment, remember that you are laying up treasures in heaven and you are taking hold of what is truly life. And then you will have true joy, deep peace, and real contentment in Christ, who is our treasure. Let's pray together.